Well, okay, thank you for the opportunity to give this talk. It will be a talk about a recently developed method for solving impurity models. And basically, our motivation to work on impurity models is because they appear in dynamical mean field theory. So I will give a brief introduction to dynamical mean field theory and explain the existing methods which have been used for the past 15 years to solve the impurity problems. And then in the main part of the talk, I will explain my new method, which is based on a diagrammatic expansion of the partition function in the impurity bath hybridization. And in the second part of the talk, I will show some applications to the doping-driven mod transition in the one-band Hubbard model, to the Holstein-Hubbard model, condylattice model, and some multi-orbital models with spin exchange. And this work was started back at ETH during the final few months of my PhD, and then mainly carried out after I moved to Columbia University to work with Andy Millis. And Emmanuel Gull is a student of Matthias who helped me implement some of the most recent codes. So let's start with a very short reminder about mean field theory for an easing model. This model is not solvable in high dimensions, but what works well in high dimension is mean field theory, and the idea here is to replace the lattice model by a single site effective model. So we pick, say, the black spin here and replace the remaining the influence of the remaining degrees of freedom on this black spin by an external magnetic field, H effective, which can be defined in terms of the magnetization on the neighboring sites. And from this single site effective model, we can again obtain an estimate for the magnetization, and the self-consistency condition demands that this estimate from the single site model be the same as the magnetization in the lattice model. And in the easing case, we can express this in closed form. Now, dynamical mean field theory is an attempt to formulate a similar mean field approximation for fermionic lattice models. The idea is again to replace a lattice problem with a single site effective problem, which in this case becomes a quantum impurity model. So the idea is again to extract one site, which becomes the quantum impurity, and replace the remaining degrees of freedom of the lattice by a bath of non-interacting electrons. And processes where an electron hops from this black site into the bath and after some excursion through the lattice returns to the original site are described in this simplified model by transitions from the impurity into the bath and back. The amplitude for this transition are these hybridizations V. And at this stage, we can integrate out the bath degrees of freedom. And if we do that, these transitions into the bath and back are described by a non-local hybridization function, which I call F.
Is it non-interacting?
Yeah, the bath is non-interacting. That's why you can trace it out. And it will lead to this retarded interaction, F. And again, we have a self-consistency condition, which in this case demands that the Green's function, which we obtain from the single site effective model, is the same as the local, that means wave vector averaged, Green's function of the lattice model. And in practice, a DMFT calculation works as follows. We start with some hybridization function. We solve the impurity model, that is, we compute the impurity Green's function. We extract the self-energy. And then we make contact with the original lattice model by identifying the lattice self-energy with the self-energy of the impurity model. And at this stage, we make some approximation a rather crude approximation of the momentum dependence of the self-energy, which in single-site DMFT is completely neglected. But once we have this estimate for the self-energy, we can compute the local lattice Green's function, then we can use the self-consistency condition to define a new hybridization function and iterate this process until convergence is reached.
So what kind of K-plan?
Well, in single-site DMFT, if we only use impurity with a single site, we completely neglect. And then people came up with cluster extensions where one considers a small cluster with, say, four sites, and that allows one to capture the momentum dependence on a very coarse grained level. No, my method, I mean, I will explain the method for single site dynamical mean field theory, but it can be extended to clusters, so that's not a real issue. But anyhow, yeah, so the important approximation involved in DMFT calculations is the simplification of the momentum dependence of the self-energy, and on the practical level, such a calculation involves the repeated numerical solution of impurity models. And basically the lack of appropriate impurity solvers has really kind of hampered progress in this field.
If you apply this method to free electrons on the beta lattice, does it give the correct result? Because presumably even there's some kind of spatial dependence in the wave functions.
I know, for free electrons, you get the right. I mean, you have the momentum dependence of the lattice is captured here on this dispersion. But you don't have a self-energy. I mean, the self-energy is just zero. Yeah, so this works for the non-interacting case.
Where?
Yeah, that's here. I mean, here you have the dispersion of the lattice.
So EK is code. EK is
code. Yes, that enters. That's where the lattice enters through this EK. But you don't have a self-energy. Yeah, if we want, yes, right. Mm-hmm.
So just to make sure, so this self-consistency is not derived from an exponential principle, is it? It's just written down, or like in mean field theory, like the first slide you showed, right? You can formalize that many levels of sophistication, saddle points, and so on and so on. So. My question is what's happening about the justification for the self-consistency for the mean function?
Well, I think there is you can kind of derive this formalism also from a similar principle where you maximize some self-energy functional, which is what I'm...
But is this variation in the sense that the field theory gives you bounds on the partition function, not the bounds on the field? Is this actually very...
No, I suppose this gives you the best approximation given this approximation on the momentum dependence of the self-energy.
Yes. Is it some loose way, or in a well-defined way, there's a measure that tells you that this is the best?
Well, it's the best given that approximation, but it's not a variational approach.
Uh-huh, because then somehow the momentum dependence drops out of the self-energy.
I'm not sure,
Anyhow, so this is just kind of the motivation for us to work on this crucial step here.
Just to clarify, when you say impurity solver, what are you actually solving? You have the impurity, whatever the cluster, in the presence of a vacuum, the constant density of states, or what is the boundary solving here?
Well, I have, I mean, the bath is kind of encoded in this hybridization function. Mm-hmm. And I want to solve some sort of cluster or multi-orbital system with some type of hybridization to the bath.
And when you specify it by the bath at this stage?
Well, originally I choose it randomly. But for the impurity solver, I don't care what is F. That's just even. And in this sort of calculation, it's determined self-consistently. But if I want to study an atom cluster or something like that, it's given. I mean, it's just a known or whatever, due to the hybridization to the substrate or something like that.
You have these things calculated.
Well, in well, it's not relevant. The self-consistency is not relevant for the what I will discuss now. But in a DMFT calculation, you add the self-consistency on top of that. So the most frequently used method for the past 15 years was probably the method by Hirsch and Fei, which I will now briefly discuss for the effective action, which corresponds to a one-band Hubbard model. So we decompose this action into a quadratic term, which contains the hybridization and the chemical potential and an interaction term. And then the method relies on the discretization of the imaginary time interval into many small slices, and then employs a discrete Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation to decouple the interaction term on each time slice.
At this stage, what is F? Arbitrary or
arbitrary, yeah.
Arbitrary.
Yes. And so this Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation creates the interaction terms for auxiliary easing spin variables. Once we have decoupled all the interaction terms in this way, the remaining action is quadratic in the fermionic operators, and we can trace out the fermionic operators. And then that yields an expression which is sum over easing spin configurations of some product of determinants. And the Monte Carlo sampling proceeds by randomly updating the auxiliary field variables. And the problem with this approach is twofold. First of all, we only have this type of decoupling scheme for density-density interactions, and nobody has come up with a decent way of decoupling, for example, a spin exchange term. So in practice, Hirsch-Fei only works for density-density interactions. And the other limitation is that in the strongly correlated regime, the Green's function, say for a metallic solution, is highly non-uniform. It drops very steeply near the endpoints, zero and beta, and it varies more slowly in between. And if you want to capture this sort of time evolution if we want to resolve this with a discrete grid, with a uniform grid, we need a large number of time slices, and that means very large determinants which have to be updated. And this practice limits the method to high temperatures or weak interactions. Now, 10 years ago, Prokofiev and Swistunov realized that Monte Carlo simulations can be formulated in continuous time, so we don't need a time discretization. And what a continuous time Monte Carlo method is nothing else than a stochastic sampling of Feynman diagrams. And in the case of bosonic models, we can sample individual diagrams, and that's the so-called worm algorithm, which is a very powerful tool for bosonic models. But generalization of this idea to fermionic models has happened only very recently, and Rubtsov and Lichtenstein were the first ones to propose an impurity solver based on this idea. And their solver employs a weak coupling expansion, so they decompose the action again into a quadratic term and an interaction term, but now they expand this exponential into powers of the interaction. And then what's left, the non-interacting or the unperturbed action is quadratic in the operator C and C dagger, and that means they can use Wick's theorem to trace out the fermionic degrees of freedom and obtain again some expression for the partition function in terms of products of determinants. But this time, the size of these determinants is given by the perturbation order, and the Monte Carlo sampling proceeds now by randomly inserting and removing interaction vertices and thereby sampling all the relevant perturbation orders. So while the perturbation order here, the size of the matrix changes constantly during the sampling, there is a well-defined probability distribution which is peaked at the value which is considerably lower than what you would need in time slices in a Hirsch-Phi approach. So that means this approach is much faster than Hirsch-Phi. However, because it is a weak coupling expansion, the average perturbation order still grows linearly in U, and so we still have a problem accessing the strong correlation regime. And so what I want to discuss now is the alternative procedure where we do a diagrammatic expansion in the hybridization term and treat the order, the local parts, the interaction, and the chemical potential parts exactly. And I can discuss this approach first for the non-interacting model, because that's where the main difficulties show up already. So we now want to study this model by expanding the partition function in powers of the hybridization function and evaluating the all the terms in the occupation number basis 0 and 1. So we get a series of terms like this. And we can represent these terms diagrammatically as follows. Here we have a black line which represents an electron which sits on the impurity from time 0 all the way up to time beta. So this is such a zero order term. Oh, is this the point? Oh, thanks, that's what I need. Now here we have a first order diagram where an electron hops from the bath onto the impurity. It stays on the impurity up to time tau 1 end and hops back into the bath. Here we have a second order diagram with two such hybridization processes, the third order diagram with three hybridization processes, and so on. Now the problem which we face immediately is that some of these diagrams have negative weight. Typically, the diagrams with an odd number of crossing hybridization lines have negative weight. And that means that we cannot formulate an algorithm which samples individual diagrams, because they basically cancel out completely. And the signal which we are...
Sorry?
Well, these diagrams are kind of related to an expansion in the impurity bath hybridization. Say, when you have the original model with the bath explicitly present, you would do an expansion in the hybridization term from bath to impurity.
Wait, let me just follow. In your zero order Hamiltonian, is it just the chemical potential, or is it also U?
Also, well, okay, here I consider the non-interacting model, so I only have the chemical potential.
There's no problem with Wick's theorem here.
Well, no, I cannot use Wick's theorem because I have the U term in the interaction. Well, I mean, I want to show here another trick first. I will discuss the interacting model afterwards. But Okay, so now, so basically what we conclude here is that we cannot sample individual diagrams, but instead what I propose to do is to sample certain collections of diagrams. And so the trick is the following. For a given number and position of creation and annihilation operators on the imaginary time interval, I propose to sum up all the diagrams which one can draw by connecting the creation operators to the annihilation operators through hybridization lines. So for k pair of operators, we can draw k factorial diagrams. And it turns out that the combined weight of these k factorial diagrams can be expressed as a determinant of some matrix, namely the matrix whose elements are precisely these hybridization functions evaluated at all different time intervals. And that's kind of the trick which makes this approach feasible, because first of all, these determinants resum enormous numbers of diagrams. Say a determinant of 100 by 100 matrix, which is an object which such a laptop can easily handle, this represents the combined weight of 10 to the 158 diagrams. And so I think these numbers show that diagrammatic Monte Carlo simulations for fermionic models will only work if we do some sort of analytic resummation.
Which diagrams have you left out?
I don't leave out any diagrams. I just combine them in a certain way. And then I... Basically, these are now my new Monte Carlo configurations. Once I realize that I should group the diagrams in this way, I can just forget about the hybridization lines, and my Monte Carlo configurations simply become segment configurations. And each such segment configuration now represents a whole collection of diagrams, and the weight is given by a determinant. But now, what the Monte Carlo sampling does is it samples all possible segment configurations through local updates. So we insert or remove a segment, we insert or remove the empty space between a segment, or we shift around the segment endpoints. And that way we generate all possible diagrams. But we generate them in a way which always sums up appropriate collection of diagrams such that the weights of our configurations becomes positive.
Is there any theorem about the connected or disconnected diagrams in this?
No, here I have to retain the disconnected diagrams. So in order to sum up the weights into a determinant, I have to use the disconnected diagrams. I cannot use them. I mean, it's an interesting question whether one can formulate an algorithm simply in terms of connected diagrams, because that would also sum up huge numbers of diagrams, but it will not, I think, not be possible to express the weights in terms of determinants.
So if one does this then for the interacting problem.
Right, that's next slide.
What have you left out?
I don't leave anything out. In the interacting model, what changes is that I have two segment configurations, one for the spin up, another one for the spin down. And where these segments overlap, I have a doubly occupied impurity, and that costs an energy U. So all I have to change for the interacting model is to add in the weight for the Monte Carlo configuration a factor e to the minus u times the length of the overlap between the segments, and that takes care of the repulsion. And otherwise everything remains the same. And in particular, we don't have a sign problem because that doesn't.
After you make this resummation, mm-hmm. how do you essentially have some perturbation series? How do the coefficients go with the model of the fluid? So I guess I'm asking, how does if you adjust the strength of this F,
mm-hmm.
how does the when you're expanding to a certain order, your function series diagrams up to a certain number?
Well, okay, that's shown here. So here I have a distribution of perturbation orders. Pink here for non-interacting model. So it's nicely peaked, it falls off at high high enough perturbation order. And the very interesting and useful property of this expansion is that if I increase the interaction, you can see the perturbation order shifts to lower and lower orders. So the peak of this distribution shifts to lower and lower orders.
So is the distribution something like beta to the k over k factorial? I guess what he's asking is, are these series of your convergent series?
Yeah, for finite temperature it converges, yes. And the reason why it converges is due to the fact that these time integrals are kind of, I don't know. Yeah, we only integrate over 1 over 2 k factorial of the hypercube. And that's basically the factor which cuts off the weighted high perturbation orders. So this determinant goes something, is bounded by something like k factorial. This integral comes with something like 1 over 2 k factorial. And that cuts off the contributions.
So you can actually strictly know that the convergent radius is basically zero. The convergence.
No, I have only a problem at zero temperature. I cannot simulate zero temperature, but for all finite temperatures I have a nicely peaked distribution like this. So the average perturbation order grows linearly with beta, so that means we are limited in the temperature which we can treat. But the very nice thing is that in contrast to, say, the weak coupling expansion or the Hirsch-Phi algorithm, the matrix size which we have to deal with becomes very small in the strong correlation regime. And because the computational effort of all these determinantal methods grows like the cube of the matrix size, a factor of 10 in matrix size means a huge speed up in the Monte Carlo sampling. And the other important question besides the matrix size is the sign problem. And basically empirically I find that for many types of models we don't have a sign problem, and thanks to the insights of Ribu, we understand precisely why this approach has no sign problems for models with density-density couplings. And the proof relies on the mapping of the impurity model to some sort of spin chain. And then, okay, this mapping is kind of standard for NRG calculations, for example. And once we have this spin chain, it is relatively straightforward to show that in this basis, each term in the weight, which can be expressed as some sort of trace, contributes a positive amount to the weight. And so we can understand why this approach has no sign problem for models with density-density coupling. But empirically, even for multi-orbital models with Hund's coupling, I don't measure any sign problem. But maybe it's just very weak. So in the remaining part of the talk, I would like to show a few applications. First, a very simple toy model, the one-band Hubbard model on a beta lattice with magnetism suppressed. Here I sketched a phase diagram in the space of interaction strength and temperature at half filling, and the zero temperature phase diagram in the space of interaction and chemical potential. And what one finds in the MFT is a first-order phase transition between a metal and a MOT insulator somewhere along this red line. And the hash region indicates the coexistence region where both metallic and insulating solutions to the DMFT equations exist. And this white region here shows basically which part of the phase diagram was accessible, say, to Hirsch-Phi without any extrapolations or other sophisticated tricks. And what I will show in the next slide is that with the new approach, we can zoom, for example, right into the vicinity of this critical endpoint here and study the scaling near this critical point. So,
problem going to zero temperature?
Well, I have a problem going to zero temperature, but I can easily go to about down to here. So close enough to see what happens in the vicinity of the critical point. So here I show density versus chemical potential traces for several values of U as I approach the critical point. And you can see that away from the critical point, the onset is linear, so we have a finite charge compressibility, whereas as I approach the critical point, this becomes quadratic, so the compressibility vanishes as we approach the critical point. Another question which we addressed is the issue of in-gap states. So 10 years ago, Daniel Fischer, Kotler, and Müller kind of predicted on the basis of some analytical arguments that doping a MOT insulator produces states inside the gap. And what I plot here is, first of all, the phase boundary, where the system becomes metallic. No, they ask what happens. Here we ask what happens if we shift the chemical potential inside the gap. And the statement was that at some point before we hit the Hubbard band, the upper Hubbard band, say, we will produce states in the gap. And that's basically what you can see here.
Are we shifting the chemical potential, keeping the density fixed?
Well, as long as we are in the gap, the density stays one half, say, in this half.
Generate mid-gap states, but it's moving the chemical potential. I can't feel it.
Well, at some point I will produce a state, and then the feeling will increase. And that's exactly what happens here at this red line. I start to dope the system. But what the blue curve shows is the position of the upper Hubbard band in the Hall field model. So you can see that we dope the system much before we actually hit the upper Hubbard band. And that kind of implies that we produce states inside the gap. And if we look at the spectral function, we can actually see these states. So here's such an in-gap state detached from the upper Hubbard band. And we can study how it evolves with doping and how it rapidly merges into the upper Hubbard band. So we can conclude from this that the in-gap nature of these states is only relevant for very low dopings of about 2% or so. So that was a simple toy model with one-band Hubbard model. Kind of the formalism which I presented generalizes straightforwardly to multiband models. And DMFT also allows one to incorporate material-specific information through the band structure, which enters in this self-consistency loop.
Yes? I'll go back a few transparencies to where you have the MOT transition. How does the self-energy behave at the transition?
Well, it would go, the imaginary part would go from, say, linear to divergent.
And but you still periodize your lattice green function in terms of the local self-energy. So the fact that it's diverging, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a standard way of dealing with that, but you just use you expand one over the self-energy, so you accumulate the expansion. Is that how you do things, or do you still use the self-energy to do your periodization?
Well, I still plug this divergent self-energy back into the self-consistency loop and sum over the epsilon k. And that then just produces some Green's function which drops exponentially. Anyhow, so what I wanted to mention here on this slide is that kind of one of the active research areas nowadays is the combination of DMFT with band structure calculations. So one kind of combines the band structure calculation for the weakly correlated bands with a DMFT treatment of the strongly correlated D or F electrons. And here I show some recent results obtained in collaboration with the group of Anisimov for the alpha and gamma phase of cerium. And I'm told that actually these spectral functions which come out of the calculation are very much in agreement with photoemission data. So it seems that these sort of results lend some credibility to the whole LDA plus DMFT approach. And what I also want to emphasize is that these sort of calculations, seven-band model at these low temperatures, with the Hirsch-Phi approach would have challenged the most powerful supercomputers at Oak Ridge or Livermore or whatever. Whereas with this new approach, which I described before, these are actually rather cheap calculations. We can obtain these results within a day on a single processor. So these are not at all heavy calculations. And so this example kind of shows that it's really important to work on methods and to use efficient methods, because it's the methods much more than the computer power which defines what sort of problems are ultimately doable.
What was actually the problem you wanted to get what have you been doing?
Well, basically we wanted to get these spectral functions and compare it to the experiments. And okay, here you can see that this alpha phase is much more metallic than the gamma phase and so on.
Can you say anything about the magnetic properties?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert actually on the material things. So. Yes. I mean, to study magnetism, we have to use some sort of different type of self-consistency loop. Basically, we feed back the hybridization function for the up electron to the down, and so on. That allows us to study magnetism on a crude level. And then, of course, if we go to a cluster DMFT, we can study short-range correlations explicitly. Okay, then one more thing I want to mention is, say, deal with models with density-density interactions is that this hybridization expansion approach allows us to treat models with phonon couplings, certain types of models with phonon couplings, very efficiently. And so what Andy and I figured out is, say, that for a Holstein-Hubbard model, which has a non-side repulsion and a coupling to dispersionless phonons like this, one can use a so-called Lang-Virchow transformation, which shifts the position operator of the phonons to decouple the phonons from the electrons, and then one can actually trace out analytically the phonon degrees of freedom. And what that produces is a renormalization of the interaction chemical potential and a phonon-mediated interaction between each pair of creation and annihilation operators. But otherwise, everything remains unchanged, and because these interactions are cheap to evaluate, they don't really affect the performance of the algorithm. That's very nice, because with alternative methods such as NRG or exact diagonalization, what one has to do to study a model like this is to truncate the phonon Hilbert space down to a few states. And even this truncated phonon Hilbert space adds very substantially to the computational effort. Whereas here, we don't do any approximation at all, and the phonons don't really affect the performance of the algorithm. And here I just flashed some results. For example, the phase diagram at half filling in the space of interactions and phonon coupling strength, we can identify three phases, a metallic phase, a mod insulating phase, and a bipolaronic insulating phase. We could also study the self energies and ask how they compare to Migdal-Eliasberg theory, and basically, the conclusion was in the strongly correlated metallic regime at half filling, Migdal-Eliasberg theory doesn't work at all. We get the wrong sign for the self-energy, and so on. However, in strongly doped samples, the prediction seems to work.
That was the results for adiabatic or anti-adiabatic limit? The previous results. Yes.
So, sorry, I don't understand your question.
So the lambda, you change the lambda, but what's the ratio of the phonon frequency with respect to the key?
So phonon frequency here is 0.2 in these units, so I don't know. Yeah. Whether that corresponds now to RDR. I see. Okay. So up to now I studied models with density-density interactions, which can be studied in this segment representation. However, the formalism can also be derived in a much more general way, which works for arbitrary four fermion terms. And I will not go through the derivation in detail, but I just want to show now some results for more complicated models with spin exchange processes.
But it's still within a single impurity.
My results are all for single impurity, but this formalism also works for clusters.
You implemented it for clusters?
Sorry?
You implemented this for clusters?
Yes, for four-psi cluster. Yeah.
And how does it compare in computation time for other solvers?
Well, yeah, okay, this generalized algorithm has a problem in the sense that the effort scales exponentially with number of degrees of freedom. So we are in practice limited to about 6 sites or orbitals. But it has the big advantage that we can treat arbitrary interactions, we can treat correlated hopping terms, we can treat spin exchange terms, whatever. So there's a large number of problems which can be addressed with this, yes.
Can you include, for example, 2 electrons coming in band A and B and then scattering into another band?
Pair hopping terms or?
Yeah.
Yeah, yes. Yes. Yes, no problem. The only limitation of this approach is that we cannot treat very large clusters. But we can treat arbitrary models. And first I want to illustrate now the flexibility of this approach with the simplest model which has spin exchange. And that's probably the Condor lattice model, where we have a spin 1/2 degree of freedom coupling to the spin in some localized orbital psi. And what I show here is the magnetization as a function of the exchange coupling J for several temperatures. And what this plot shows is very clearly a quantum phase transition near J equals 1 from an antiferromagnetic phase to a paramagnetic insulator. And this quantum phase transition is driven by the formation of the Condor singlet. And it would be completely missed if we would replace this spin here by a classical variable. In that case, the model would predict a positive magnetization for all values of J. So this simple model, simple example kind of shows that it is important to use a fully quantum mechanical model and to kind of develop methods which can deal with these types of interaction. Now I want to show results for a more complicated model, a two-orbital model with Hund's coupling and crystal field splitting. We have the interorbital and intraorbital Coulomb repulsion. We have the spin exchange term, pair hopping term, and the crystal field splitting, which shifts the energy of the two bands relative to each other. And we were interested in the interplay between exchange coupling, J, and crystal field splitting. The results I show here will be for half filling, so 2 electrons in 2 orbitals. Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of adjusting the chemical potential. But for Hall filling, what we find, say, in the absence of a spin exchange term, is that if we increase the interaction, the upper orbital gradually empties out and we get the transition to a band insulator. And the situation changes completely if we have a J term. Now, the filling in both orbitals starts to approach 1/2 if we increase the interaction, and eventually we get the transition to a Mott insulating state. And in between, for J's in between, we get everything in between, namely also a direct transition from a metal to a orbitally polarized insulator. And from this type of data, we can extract the phase diagram in the space of crystal field splitting and a Coulomb interaction. And this is the phase diagram without the J term. So, for example, we have a critical value of for the Mott transition, which is about 8 in the absence of a crystal field splitting. The picture changes completely if we have a J term. Now, for example, the critical value for the Mott transition is substantially reduced, and the metallic phase starts to grow this sort of nose into a direction which I will explain in a minute. And the most interesting thing is that in this model, with a J term, we get two distinct Mott insulating phases. We get the spin triplet Mott insulator, which is characterized by a vanishing orbital susceptibility. So in this Mott insulating state, if we shift, if we increase the crystal field splitting, the filling will be completely unaffected by
it. Is that phase in between
This is metal, yes. That's a metal. And that's a spin triplet Mott insulator, and that's a spin singlet insulator with finite orbital susceptibility.
And we think that actually
Right, yeah. So we can actually, yeah, we can understand what's going on basically by looking at the atomic limit.
The atomic limit is actually
right.
From what we call actually,
yeah, that's exactly what happens here. So if you study what are the low energy states in the atomic limit, you find that the spin triplet and the spin singlet levels cross at this value of delta, which is exactly along this diagonal. So, and we can also see directly what's going on by measuring the relevance of the different quantum states. So a very attractive feature of this algorithm is that we can measure directly how much each individual eigenstate of the local Hamiltonian contributes to the partition sum. And on the next slide, I will show these distributions here for this triplet insulator, for the metallic phase, and for the spin singlet insulator. And these are the distributions. So you see that in the spin triplet state, three states contribute, and these are the three spin triplet states. In the metallic phase, many states contribute to the partition sum, whereas in the orbitally polarized insulating phase, basically only the lowest energy spin singlet state contributes. So by looking at these sort of distributions, one can immediately gain an insight into the nature of the phases and into the nature of the transitions between the phases. So that's extremely useful, and that sort of information is not available by other methods. And so as the final example, I want to show some preliminary results for a three-orbital model with Hund's coupling. First, I show the phase diagram without exchange term. We have different Mott insulating states. We have one with three electrons. We have one with... Well, here I changed the chemical potential, so I have distinct Mott insulating states. This is the half filled one with three electrons. And this is the one with two electrons. And this lobe here is with one electron. And on the left, we have a band insulator with zero electrons. And that's without J. Now, if we turn on even a small chain, the situation changes completely now. So without the chain, the Hall field not insulating phase was the least stable one. Whereas if we add the chain term, this Hall field not insulating phase is stabilized very substantially. Whereas the other MOD insulators are destabilized. So they become very small. And we can then also ask, what happens if we lift the orbital degeneracy by shifting one of the bands, say, up by a little amount? Then, so here the black line shows what happens if we shift one of the band up. So the MOD insulating phase with two electrons is again substantially stabilized. The critical value is reduced by about a factor 1/2. So you can see that these multi-orbital models are very sensitive, and in particular that spin exchange terms play a very important role in these models. And Andy and I, we are still kind of trying to make sense out of this and understand kind of intuitively what's going on. But basically, the points I wanted to make is, yes, that these multi-orbital models show a very strong J dependence.
In Hall lecture, what kind of key do you include? From the diagonal orbital index or what?
I don't hop between orbitals. I only have the spin exchange and the pair hopping.
But do you have to hop between any kind of?
Well, through the hybridization into the bath. Yeah. I mean, I have hopping into the bath. Yes, I chose diagonal. Yes, yes, I choose three. Yeah, so I just use this.
What's happening to the net?
That's this hybrid in the orbitals, yeah. And I use semicircular density of states with the same bandwidth for all the orbitals. So that's just a simple toy model. But what we learn from these simple toy models is that these multi-orbital systems are very sensitive to spin exchange terms. I think it's fair to say that at the moment, basically, we don't understand what is the role of spin exchange terms in these models.
And well, the model is what really was in transition from
single to three. Yeah. Right, I mean, this is probably a spin 3/2 state, yes.
Yeah, very three-half, so one-half.
Yeah, I mean, this one can also see directly that one has a fivefold degeneracy in the states, which contribute. But anyhow, so I think one of the reasons why these models are not so well understood is because up to now we didn't have the methods to study these models. And basically now the message is now we have methods to study these models. And so I hope in the coming years we will gain some new insights into this type of physics, and thereby also some insights into the physics of transition metal oxides. And with this, I want to conclude. So I discussed a new type of impurity solver, which is based on a diagrammatic expansion in the impurity bath hybridization. The advantages of this approach is that it can access very strong couplings. It can treat basically arbitrary interactions. And yeah, so basically in the coming months and years, I want to apply this to multi-orbital models, to LDA plus DMFT calculations of strongly correlated materials. There are some methodological aspects which still need to be worked out. And one related problem, which has nothing to do with DMFT, but is nevertheless very interesting is the application of this technique to real-time dynamics. So you can easily imagine that one can implement a similar type of diagrammatic sampling on a Keldysh contour, and that yields a real-time Monte Carlo method capable of simulating transport in non-equilibrium systems. And that's what I'm working on right now, and I think that that will also be a useful method. And with this, I want to conclude. Thanks.
One very simple implementation question. When you run this loop for self-consistency, how many times typically do you need to run this thing for convergence?
About 5 to 8 times, something like that. It depends a little bit, very close to a critical point, it can be slower. So it can be up to 30 times or so if you are really very close to a critical point.
So you believe that the critical behavior that is captured in the intuitive model is the same as that in the lattice model?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I guess the only way to answer this is to go from single site to cluster the MFT and see if
that wouldn't change things.
If anything changes.
Yeah. Why wouldn't it change things?
Well, I mean,
my transition
general,
force that cluster.
No, I'm saying critical behavior is usually more dependent on things like dimensionality and so on.
Yeah, but he has a method which is exactly infinite dimensions.
No, but I'm saying going from a single site to a cluster is a change of critical behavior. Not usually, but I don't know.
Well, yeah.
Because you're simulating a real finite dimensional lattice. If you do a cluster, you're embedding it in, for example, a square lattice.
Okay, what you do is that if you do like this Isaac model and you do it like regular mean field theory with 4-site clusters, you still see transitions. You may see some change away from it.
So are you asking about the universality class, or are you asking about what properties diverge near the transition? Like the spectral weights, things like that, or?
Universal behavior, yeah,
the phase diagrams could change a lot, couldn't they?
The phase diagram could change.
Yeah.
When you're saying that your matrix approach is restricted to study like 6-site clusters, it's living in the world of your laptop and a single CPU, but if you would have approach to supercomputer centers like Oak Ridge, you could do completely larger clusters?
Well, we are working out a different implementation of this approach, which I think will allow us to create 16-site clusters. But that will require substantial resources. And I don't think it's possible to push it much further than that. It's just a method which scales exponentially, and you can implement it in a clever way, and that gets you a little further. But basically, the...
That is about what can be done at Oak Ridge right now.
Yeah, 2024, yeah. Yeah, at much higher temperatures. And also much simpler models.
The non-interacting problem that you discussed that had no minus sign, was that only in one dimension, or is it true for any lattice in any dimension? Initially you discussed just a non-interacting problem, and you said?
Non-interacting problem, any dimension can be written as a one-dimensional problem.
Mm-hmm. I mean all...
can be written as a, on any lattice.
We don't want to try diagonal.
So all models which have only density-density couplings don't have a sign problem, that's for sure. And for these multi-orbital models, I mean, for these type of models, I just find in practice I don't see a sign problem. You can see these interactions are huge, and I don't run into a sign problem.
Yeah,
So in practice, I can treat fairly complicated models without running into a fine problem. But I don't claim that in the general case we have strictly no fine problem.
Are there examples where there are fine problems?
Well, I heard some rumors from other people who have implemented the method that for strongly frustrated plaquettes, they get the sign problem. But I haven't verified it myself. So it seems that, okay, one can come up with models which have a sign problem.
Did you look at the Mach transition on a four-step cluster?
One of my collaborators does, yes.
And what changes from a single-site problem to...
Well, one runs into a so-called Slater transition, where basically one suddenly has some antiferromagnetic short-range correlations at fairly small u.
And do the phases, does anything substantial change? In terms of, for example, if you look at how the spectral weight changes as you go through the transition, finite dimensional lattice should have a fairly different spectral weight transfer as a single site problem.
Well, these are always kind of hard questions to address because we have to do some sort of analytic continuation, which are a bit hand waving. But yeah, at the moment, I don't know.
Thank you.